Hi guys, so in this episode, we are going to be looking at ULEZ and other motoring restrictions that are infringing on our rights and freedom, so to speak. Now, it's always too easy to let emotions and politics steer these conversations, but I think it's important to focus on cold, hard facts and expert knowledge, you know, apply logic, especially when it comes to tackling such contentious issues as the twin challenges of air pollution and environmental damage. Now, I feel that it is seasoned experts who hold the keys to realistic solutions when it comes to these things. These are the people who've not only studied these issues, but have lived and breathed them and had a tangible impact on the ground. So in this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by a freight transport specialist and a career, you know, he's got a career that spans government and international transport companies and industry advocacy. So we're going to be talking to him and we're going to be doing that right after this. A brown car guy. So Duncan Buchanan has worked in the freight industry for government organizations and for the Road Haulage Association. For 20 years, he worked for international transport companies across modes, covering road, rail, sea, and air freight transport. Now, Duncan has extensive policy experience at senior level. He has developed and assessed policy positions within and outside government. In fact, he worked for the UK government in Europe and on behalf of the freight transport industry in the UK. This includes work on sustainable transport and environmental benefit assessments. He's given evidence to parliamentary committees and talked on a diverse range of topics, including sustainable transport, decarbonization, the impacts of government policy on commercial transport, and indeed on road charging as well. So this should be a fascinating conversation. Welcome, Duncan. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and thanks for that very kind introduction.
How are we doing today? So we've had some interesting news, haven't we? But before we get into that, let's talk a little bit more about yourself and a little bit of, I mean, I introduced you as somebody that's been involved at the very highest levels of policymaking, but also at the hands-on ground level of actually dealing with road transport. Tell us a little bit about how that's probably shaped your thinking and your experience.
Well, I think it always comes down to the practical. Coming from an operational background, coming from a background where it was always about delivering for the customer. And I think when you move into the policy world, the customer and the real performance, the getting whatever it is to where it ever needs to go to by a certain time, that starts getting lost a little bit. And if I was going to say one of my observations of policy making is that it can be a bit divorced from the day in, day out reality of how things go from place A to place B. And you can certainly see that with the ULEZ issues and with issues around air quality, where people are just disregarding what the white van man side of things. They're not looking at how they are going to be impacted by things, because you're looking at cars, you're looking at satisfying the political niceties, and you're forgetting that in the real world we still need stuff every single day. So just like you're the brown car guy, I suppose I'm the white freight guy, because you know I'm a freight guy,
You were almost a white van man there. That would have been perfect, actually, wouldn't it?
Yeah, no, I did. One of the jobs that I did do was running vans, but they were blue, and it was only a couple of them anyway. That actually helps.
You know what? I want to stick with this a little bit, because you've dived straight into ULEZ, and this is very good and it's very important, because obviously this is still a contentious issue, even though the fact is that ULEZ expansion has now happened and it is now covering the whole of Greater London, making this actually the largest low emission zone in the world. And like you said, just trying to separate the fact from the policies, if you like, you know, the real world facts on the ground. And I think this is one of the things that has emerged for me so much, especially when I've gone to protest events and spoken to people, is how it's impacted real people in the real world, as opposed to, you know, these lofty ambitions and aims that politicians like to champion.
I think that's a real disconnect. And the other thing that I think happens as well is that people allow their biases to take hold. they listen to people who agree with them and dismiss and ignore those who have other views. So when it comes to, say, the white van man or the small business operator, when it comes to those people and thinking about clean air zones and ULEZ, it's the small business that has been largely disregarded. I remember in 2017, when I would not long joined the RHA, looking at the impact assessment that was done by the DEFRA around clean air zones when they were talking about what they were going to do and what have you. And there was a little section in there of like, we know this is going to be bad for small businesses, for small truck operators in particular, but we don't know how bad, and there's loads of them anyway, so we're just not going to count it. And it literally was in the impact assessment. And one of the things that I learned when I was at the RHA is that one of the most important documents, if you really want to know what's going on, one of the most important documents is the impact assessment. When it comes to ULEZ, the impact assessment that the mayor did for the ULEZ expansion basically said it does sod all for air quality. It really does a negligible amount of good for air quality.
Let's just explore this a little bit further, because I obviously did a video on the impact assessment report. This was months back when when I first started looking into this, you know. And it would be great to get some what your take was on it exactly, so that people know that, I mean, I wasn't just, you know, being emotive. I am the brown car guy. I'm a car guy, so I'm into cars. So obviously, I'm going to look at it from that point of view. But my understanding of it, as I was reading through this document, my jaw was dropping and my eyes were widening, because I was, and this was just in the first, 10 pages or so, when we got into the table aspect of it, and it started breaking down not only the impact of air pollution, but also the socioeconomic impact on communities in certain areas, the demographics and people and how it would impact them. And tell me, did I read it wrong when I said to people that I saw a lot of lines there where it literally said negative impact, negative impact, negative impact?
No, you didn't read it wrong. It was really interesting because I did a little bit of a similar exercise. I was concerned about ULEZ, and what I wanted to do is I wanted to know more. And it wasn't just about ULEZ, because I was thinking in terms of decarbonisation as well. So the little exercise I did recently that I published on LinkedIn, that the reason why you contacted me, was because I wanted to understand what the carbon impact of the scrappage scheme was or is.
So before we get into that, let's just explain the scrappage scheme.
The scrappage scheme is the mayor will give you up to £2,000 to throw away your existing vehicle that's non-compliant with ULEZ if you live in London. Only if you live in London. If you live just outside London, tough. You're just going to have to wear whatever you're wearing. So I wanted to know, having...
And this is potentially up to, because obviously there was a £110 million budget for this, allocated to this. I think it was increased to about 150, if I'm not mistaken. But when you look at the government, from the government's point of view, they said 1 in 10 cars would be impacted by this, which by their assessment equated to about 200,000 cars. But the RAC said it could be 700,000 cars. So we're talking of up to, let's say up to about 100,000 cars could be impacted by this scrappage scheme. So you're talking about scrapping 100,000 cars. And then you looked into what the impact of that would be.
Yeah, because looking at going back to the impact assessment, there was nothing in the impact assessment about scrappage. So there were some vague claims about carbon and about climate change reasons for doing ULEZ. And one of the problems is it's the vagueness of the claims. It's using conventional wisdom. There's no data behind it. And I was really uncomfortable with all of that. So I thought, having done assessments myself in the past, I would look at it myself. And when I looked at the impact assessment, I remember being quite stunned when I got to the very last part of the impact assessment is that thing you were talking about, those 35 different socioeconomic groups that have negative impacts. And I think there was two that, for which there was positive impacts. And it really strikes you as, okay, it's 130 pages into a turgid document. but it's there. And one of the good things about impact assessments is that the consultants who do impact assessments generally put almost all of the information in there, and they can't really hide it. So in this particular case, it was Jacobs, and they were really straightforward. I've read Jacobs' work in the past, and they are straight. They do the consult. But of course, it does get edited by the TFL or the commissioner, and they engineer it so that it's structured in a way that it tells the story they want to tell. And it will always pick out certain types of information that can be used by the proposer. But generally speaking, the consultants, whether it's Ricardo on air quality or Jacobs or any of these people, they generally have good quality information.
Just to interrupt you for a second there, sorry to stop your flow there, but just for a second, that struck me as extraordinary. Because coming to this report as somebody that's probably not an expert at looking at these reports, and it didn't take me long to see the negative aspects in this report. And that's despite the fact that, as you say, it's probably been tailored in such a way as to present a positive benefits for it. So that's extraordinary. So please continue.
Well, you see, this is where the consultation is different from the impact assessment. The impact assessment has the real information in there. The consultations don't. So you get a consultation on a low traffic neighborhood, and it will give you four options. Option A is one type of low traffic neighborhood, B is another, C is another, and the third one is another. There will be no option for no low traffic neighborhood, and that's really quite common. The consultations are where the faking really happens. The impact assessments is where you can get real information, and there's good information in there. But even so, it's not just about what's in the impact assessment, it's what's missing. And that's what I realized, is that there was a vague claim about carbon. And I thought, hold on, you're scrapping cars. What is the carbon impact of scrapping cars? So I went back to first principles and I went, right, you have a car, you scrap it, you replace it with a new car. Ultimately, all scrapped cars get replaced by a new car, or most of them do.
Well, you know, that's a good point, because somebody told me recently, somebody from the industry, that in the UK, we've always hovered at the total overall vehicle car park is about 38, 39 million, and pretty much stayed at that level. So you're absolutely right. So for every car that gets scrapped, or every vehicle that gets scrapped, inevitably, there will be a new one to replace it.
Yeah, and that's a general principle. When I did my calculations in this particular instance, I made it 90%. Nine out of 10 of the cars scrapped will be replaced, because 1 in 10, someone's going to be using, they're scrapping an old car, but they don't need a second car because they will do other things with their transport. They will catch the bus, or they will pocket the £2,000. So you can't say it's going to be 100%. So I thought, well, I'll just relax at 10% there.
Fair enough.
And I did all sorts of calculations looking at the average fleet composition as it exists today. So 15% of cars are EVs, 47% are petrol or diesel, the rest are hybrids. You work out what the carbon impact of those new vehicles are, and then you factor in the fuel use, because there is a fuel use gain, a small fuel use gain, and then you can work out what the impact of scrapping cars are. And the number I used for the amount of cars to be scrapped is the mayor's number. About a week or 10 days ago, he said 15,000 approvals for scrappage have already been given, and another 14,000 had been applied for. And this was probably about, this probably would have been on the day that the ULEZ was coming in, or the day before, something like that. So a week, 10 days ago. So I thought, well, I'll use 29,000 as a number. You have a number that you can then say, this is a number that has a basis in reality. So you scrap 29,000 cars. What is the impact of that? And so I worked all through the numbers, took into account.
Just to confirm to people that these cars, because there's been a lot of speculation inevitably this happens on YouTube, where people are like, oh, the cars get sent abroad or they end up in fields. But as far as I understand it, with this current scrappage scheme, you need to scrap the car and get a certificate before you can actually get your money. So therefore, these cars have actually been scrapped.
Yes, they have. I believe that's the way it's done. I believe that Gordon Brown did something similar in 2008-09 in an effort to support the car industry, I believe, or to encourage diesel uptake at the time. And I think when they really analysed what had happened, they realised they'd just wasted all of the money. It's a waste of money. And I come from this. My bias in all of this is I believe scrappage is a waste of money. These cars are old cars. They're going to be disappearing in a year, two, three, 4 years, slightly longer for the diesels. You're getting rid of things where you've already used the carbon to make them. And the gain from ULEZ is negligible, nothing in terms of air quality. It's almost like you could do a case study on how not to do a policy using ULEZ expansion. It really is that bad. Anyway, so I worked out what the carbon impact is going to be. So in the end, 29,000 cars, 34,500 tons of CO2 net added to the environment. That's taking into account all the benefits.
This is purely from the process of scrapping.
This is from scrapping and replacing with new cars.
Right, okay, gotcha.
Yeah. And that's taking into account the whole life cycle of the vehicles. So, in fact, the actual scrappage itself is four or five times that in terms of the carbon impact directly. But you've got to net off the fact that these cars have to be replaced in a few years' time anyway. You have to, and there is some fuel savings to be had. And the electric vehicles will have a lower footprint for carbon in their use. So this is taking all of those factors into account. And yes, you're adding CO2 through ULEZ scrappage. Simple as that.
So what was that figure again? How much were we adding?
34,500 tons of CO2. It's the equivalent of, I worked it out, I wrote it down here, it's the equivalent of annual use of electricity of 45,000 houses.
Oh, wow.
Right, so it's the annual electricity emissions from 45,000 houses. In the big scheme of things, it's probably not absolutely fantastic.
No,
but
I mean,
it is.
You know, I mean, to the end of the day, we're talking about UK carbon emissions is about what 330 million, I think, tons, isn't it?
Yeah. So in the big scheme of things, but really, I was doing this because I wanted to know and understand. And start the, if you like, my lobbying or debate, if you like, on how we should not do stupid things because they sound good. We should do things because the evidence shows them to be good.
Yeah.
And that's where I come from. And that's possibly because of, you know, running things in the Department for Transport where you're assessing complex modal shifts stuff and doing this sort of work. I like to know that what I'm doing is good, is actually positive. And
so on that basis, if we look at the scrappage scheme in isolation and we say that, well, he spent 130 million pounds, whatever it was, on scrappage, and actually what you ended up with was negative carbon impact because you put out 34,400 tons. But what is the counter to that? What was the perceived benefit, if any, of doing this?
Well, the whole rationale for doing ULEZ was air quality benefits, which if when you go into the impact assessment, they are shown to be largely minor and negligible. Are the terms that I think are used in the impact assessment. So there's a negligible gain. And I think one of the problems with ULEZ is if you go down the road of going, well, what do you do? What will you do instead? Is probably a fair question to ask. Well, that is a really good question to ask because you should think about what do you do to improve air quality. Now, as a society, many, many years ago, we did it through vehicle standards. And that's what's being used for ULEZ. It's the Euro 6, Euro 5, Euro 4. It's that continuous improvement of standards of new vehicles that helps us. So we have been consistently reducing air pollution in London across all of Europe for the last 30 years or so as the Euro standards have developed. So that works. And essentially what you do is you're not throwing anything away. You're just making sure that the new ones have the right standard and are as clean as possible. So that's all good. So that's the first point. You actually use that as your starting point. And that's what ULEZ uses. The trouble is that ULEZ is a very extreme example. Not only is ULEZ the biggest in Europe, it is also probably the most draconian in its standards. It's gone from no one had anything to comply with a month ago. Now you have to apply, if you've got a diesel, you have to apply to the Euro 6 standard. The mayor's also hinted that he wants to improve that standard. So it will be Euro 6D at some point in the future, which means that it's not just 2016 diesels and older. It's going to be 2020 and older. So I'm worried about this continuous ratcheting for very, very small gains.
And just continuing with your concept of looking at scrappage schemes, but now that you've mentioned the Euro 6D, and the fact that it's from 2020 onwards. So essentially you're talking about making...
That was a guess, by the way. 2020 is a guess. I'm not sure when it was. Okay. We can blame Volkswagen
for all. I know Euro 7 is coming in, and Euro 7 is coming in about a couple of years, isn't it?
I think it's still being discussed. I'm not sure when Euro 7 is coming in. I wouldn't expect it to be here until really probably 2028, something like that. But that's, again, like my 2020 for the Euro 6D, that's a bit of a guess as well.
So the point though I was trying to make is that you're talking about, so January, I've just done a quick Google, it's January 2022.
Right.
Is the all cars must pass the real world test with lower. This standard is known as Euro 6D. So what that tells us is that in 2022, Euro 6D was introduced. Now, if, for example, suddenly the goalposts are moved and he says, right now it has to be Euro 6D. So you're talking about cars. I mean, 2022, that's just a year ago. I mean, a year and 9 months ago, right? So yes. Cars less than 2 years old, you're just saying all of a sudden that these perfectly good cars are now redundant. I mean, what impact is that having on society by making these relatively new cars effectively redundant?
Yeah. In all fairness, that hasn't. It's a bit like what the government has been saying at the moment about not eating meat. It hasn't actually been proposed.
Yeah.
But it's in
hypothetically. I say hypothetically, but effectively we've done that already because 2015 diesel SUVs, I mean, my neighbor has one. He's just having to sell his car now. It's a perfectly good car. It's got many, many years of life left into it. And you can see these all over London, you know, diesel SUVs. 2015 vintage and say 2012, 2013, 2014, these are still very, very good cars.
I come from the freight perspective. So when it comes to vans, so just to move back to the freight just for a moment, trucks and buses have had to comply with real world emission standards since 2014. So there was a low emission zone for trucks that was introduced across London, across all of Greater London, a couple of years ago, at Euro 6 as the standard. Euro 6 is a fantastic standard. It works really, really well. And it is great. The trouble is if you introduce a standard halfway through a vehicle's life cycle, you effectively destroy the value of that vehicle. So your neighbor has had a much heavier depreciation on his 2015 car than otherwise would have been the case. It makes it more expensive for them to upgrade. And I go back to the point that I made earlier on where we've gone from no standards to quite serious standards. And that's nowhere else in Europe have done that. It's only the UK which has gone to the Euro 6 diesel standard straight from nothing. Most parts of Europe have gone through Euro 4 as a standard, then Euro 5, and then Euro 6, and it progresses over time. You don't get the dislocation in the used market. You don't get anywhere near the sort of problems we've got. But when it comes to vans, your neighbor can go and buy the same SUV with a petrol engine, probably swap it out. He'll be a few thousand pounds down, but he'll have the same car which meets his needs. He will spend a bit more on fuel. He'll spend a few thousand on the car, but he'll end up with the same thing. Roughly speaking, not a huge cost in the big scheme of things. Vans, there are no petrol alternative vans to buy. There is only diesel. So you're talking about everyone, every carpet fitter, every plumber, every electrician who's got a 2016, 2015, 2014 diesel van has nowhere to go but to buy something newer. And there isn't enough of them. So there's a load of people out there who are actually paying £12.50 a day to work because their van is non-compliant. I've got neighbours near me. I live in South London. I've got neighbours live near me. They've had exactly this issue. There's a guy who's a carpet fitter. His van's perfectly good. It's a 2013 or whatever. He does almost no mileage. He's fitting carpets locally around the area, right? He's paying £12.50 a day. He has to earn £20 a day to pay that £12.50 because he's got to pay tax on it. I suppose he does. Maybe it's an expense. Maybe he doesn't have to pay tax. But anyway,
yeah, I mean, I think you can claim it as a tax. But also the other thing to keep in mind is that with many of these commercial vehicles, vans and other vehicles in that arena, many of them are actually modified and customized to suit the needs. So that's an additional expense. So you're looking at an expense of replacing the vehicle, but then also the expense of then readapting that vehicle to your requirements. I mean, for a lot of businesses, it's literally a business busting thing, isn't it?
Yeah. The reason I'm so sensitive to this is because when we were dealing in the RHA with clean air zones and some of the things that some of the councils were wanting to do, we'd have members of ours who would have specialist vehicles. They would be adapted for particular purposes. One of the ones that we tried to get exemptions for were recovery vehicles, vehicles that recover buses and trucks. These are specialized, dirty, great big things for picking up a truck. Well, these things last forever, practically, because, well, they're doing no mileage. They're just lifting trucks up. These things, punishing those people for really expensive £100,000 specialist kit, now has to pay £50 a day. They're just paying it. It just becomes a tax. It's a pay to pollute thing for those people. So there's a lot of things around the effects on small businesses, because it tends to be small businesses with the older vehicles. DHL, UPS, all their vehicles will be compliant because they don't keep them for more than a couple of years, 3 or 4 years. They then get to the second user, then it gets to the third user. And so you've got a carpet fitter with a secondhand van who does hardly any miles. It's already done 130,000 miles before he's got it. He's only going to put another 20,000 miles on this thing in the next 2 years, 3 years. So they use old vans. So again, throwing away old stuff to buy new stuff just doesn't make a great deal of sense. We need to be...
And let's stick with that for a moment, because one of the arguments that I've always said is, I've always said the old car is the best car for the environment. And like you say, we can get a lot of use out of vans, which actually ultimately aren't, like you say, not doing that much pollution because they're only being used for specific purposes. That's what they go out and they do a job, and that's why they're used. So how much damage are we potentially doing by, you know, cutting short the life of these perfectly usable vans and commercial vehicles?
Well, I, again, part of what I was doing in this assessment, to work things out, you need to look at what happens in the real world. And so that's why you net off gains from improved fuel efficiency and what have you. And really, I learned three things from this work. The first thing I learned was that scrappage adds a lot of CO2. The second thing I learned was keeping existing petrol vehicles for a period of time more is actually a low carbon solution. And I worked it out, and on the basis of what I worked out, it's not a huge number. But comparing a petrol car to an EV, whole life cycle, you are much better keeping that petrol car for 1 year longer, for about 7,000 miles longer. Now, I'm talking about the hot, that's instead of a 14-year lifespan, you're talking about a 15-year lifespan. This is end-of-life stuff. So in 15 years' time, you have an entire year's worth of cars that haven't been bought, if you see. So that was the second thing I learned, that keeping existing cars for a little bit longer saves carbon. I also learned, and this is interesting given where we are today with the 2030 thing, I also looked at, do electric vehicles make sense on a whole life cycle stage? And they do. They really, really do. Whole life cycle, a new EV will save over its life a bit over 50% of the carbon that a petrol car will emit. That's taking into account fuel use. That's taking into account grid CO2 and the manufacturing of the vehicle. So 2030 makes a lot of sense if you want to save.
What's the life cycle that you're applying?
I applied 111,000 miles and 14 years.
14 years, okay.
Which is
comparable to ICE cars.
No, I didn't. What I didn't do was I didn't do anything different for EV compared to petrol. There's a load of people who make claims that EVs are going to last longer, and there's a load of people who make claims that EVs are going to be toast in 10 years.
Well, this is it. I mean, I'm just thinking now, because I'm just thinking that people are going to watch this. You are going to get comments saying that, well, yes, EVs are dead by less than 10 years because the batteries are useless and the cost of changing the batteries is prohibitive. So a lot of people, the perception at the moment, and I'm playing devil's advocate here, the perception at the moment is that EVs generally will have a shorter life cycle than ICE vehicles because the technology will just wear out, the batteries will just wear out. There is also an element of the fact that the technology in the EV world is changing so fast that people are upgrading more often. This is what I found. I mean, this may be anecdotal, but I found that whereas, you know, with cars, the technology is generally maintained, you know, for the life cycle of the car, which in the car world is 5 to 7 years. But with an EV, it seems like every year we're getting better batteries, we're getting better range, we're getting quicker charging times. So there's almost an incentive to keep upgrading constantly because you're getting the better vehicle. So generally, there's a perception that they will last less, their life cycle will be shorter. And also there's a perception that they're going to be worth less because of that very fact.
I considered that all of those things when I was looking at what assumptions to make. I even delved into vehicle statistics to look at what happens to old electric vehicles. The problem is that if you're doing this sort of work, there are relatively few examples, and you know that the 10-year-old EVs are not the same as the EVs we have today. There was another factor that I didn't take into account in some of this work. As a car gets older, same happens to trucks, by the way. As vehicles get older, they do lower mileages on average. So you might have a car that's 15 years old, but it's not doing a high mileage, because if it was doing a high mileage, you would need a newer one because you want the reliability. So as cars get older, they tend to have lower mileages. So you have something like a Nissan Leaf that's 10 or 12 years old. It's lost half its battery range, say. Those battery ranges in the first place were really low. We're now talking about a Corsa. Let's use a Corsa E. Over 200 miles battery range when it's new. Used in a city, in 10 years' time, if it's got 50% of its range, it will have over 100 miles usable range. And in a city, that is a worthwhile vehicle to have. It's doing lower mileages. So in the end, I thought to myself, I can't prove one way or the other which way this is going to flop. So I treated them both the same. And I contented myself with the fact that with the high battery ranges that we're getting in modern cars today, these vehicles are likely to last. One thing I did when I did the statistics, and this is an interesting one, and again, it's too new. I did notice that 2 and 3 year old electric vehicles were being taken out of the market quicker than petrol and diesel cars.
Yeah.
And I believe that may well be to do with the fact that we've got a lot of these cars coming onto the market. They get damaged in accidents and they're not being repaired necessarily quickly enough. Now, I suspect that is a transitional issue. As we get better with electric vehicles, we will actually repair them better. So again, I observed something and I thought, I'm just going to ignore that because it might or might not be a thing in 10 years' time. So let's just stick with the 14 years, 111,000 miles. These are the UK averages, by the way.
Yeah.
111,000 miles average lifespan, 14 years average lifespan. Just treat them both the same. Keep them, don't try and mess too much with stuff.
Well, you know, you won't get any argument from me about electric cars because, as you know, I review a lot of cars and I've reviewed a lot of electric cars and they're just getting better and better. And I think they're actually very good solutions for a lot of people. But I think what you're saying makes a lot of sense. But you're from the road haulage industry. And in that, and I've spoken to a lot of people and they say that for a lot of those applications, the electric vehicle technology just is not up to it at the moment.
I've actually been on, having done this work and finding out those three things, that 2030 made sense for cars. I'm assuming that you're going to be able to charge your cars pretty seamlessly. The idea that you need a membership to use a charger and all of that sort of thing, that's the market's not going to put up with that forever. So let's assume that you are going to be able to use cars that are electric, battery electric, and they're going to be practical. They spend most of their time parked. A van or a truck spends most of its time working. And there's a driver being paid sitting in that vehicle all the time it's working. Now, if that van or truck is sitting there on charge and there's a guy twiddling his thumbs, it's a waste. You're wasting time. Now, I know that the truck manufacturers are looking at really super big batteries. They're looking at trying to get charging, megawatt charging. Megawatt charging is sort of the baseline, what they need to make this work so that the truck can charge within the time required. But it's unproven. It's so unproven that we just don't know that this is going to work in all circumstances. Now, some urban distributions, certainly battery electric vehicles are going to be fine, going to be great for certain applications. The problem is, and it's a bit like this ULEZ thing where they talk about the 10% for whom are going to have to pick up the tab. It's the tyranny of the majority, if you like. Okay, it suits most people, but there will be people where it doesn't suit. And we have, when it comes to freight, you have lots of different types of uses. So when I was putting this thing on the web, I actually made the point that this is to do with cars. I don't think we can do a 2030 for vans, and I certainly don't think we can do the 2035, 2040 plans for trucks as things stand. I could be wrong. We could actually find ourselves in a much better position.
I was just going to say
that, you know, just think about the situation in Scotland. Lots of hills, not many places to charge. Wales will be the same. Yorkshire, North Yorkshire will be the same. You're doing long distances, hilly environments in the middle of winter. And these things will burn through the battery really quickly. And then you're saying that you need megawatt charging to keep these things charging. It doesn't work.
Is hydrogen a possible solution for the freight industry?
Hydrogen is incredibly wasteful of energy. It takes a lot of energy to make hydrogen. So I'm not even sure that hydrogen is the right thing. Where we go to decarbonize trucks, heavy trucks, is still up for grabs. There may be a role for hydrogen, but intuitively, I'm really not convinced. Battery electrics are limited. Is this where you need your low carbon liquid fuels? They're going to be expensive. It's unavoidable. But are we talking about low carbon fuels? And again, if we only have, there's something called HVO, which is a hydrogenated vegetable oil. I've probably got the term wrong, but HVO is seen as a low carbon liquid fuel, a drop-in fuel for diesels. Now some companies mandate that the trucking companies have to use HVO. It's a lot more expensive, 30 pence a litre or so more expensive, maybe more now. I'm probably a bit out of date. But some companies are saying, no, we want you to use it. You're working for me. Big international corporation wants to be seen to be green. I want zero carbon. I want to be able to say my distribution is zero carbon. They save 90% of the fossil fuels because it's grown and it's waste products and it's so on. But there's not enough of it to go around. You can't run cars on it, which is fine because cars will be battery electric. Most trucks, a lot of trucks, maybe battery electric will work, but there will be uses where it won't, and internal combustion engines are going to be needed. So one of the things that I was always concerned about with government policy in this area was they talk about zero tailpipe, and that means hydrogen or battery electric. And I don't think that's enough. I think we need other options for the heavy freight market, which are around low carbon liquid fuels, because we need them to be deployable. Now, it may end up being hydrogen has a role, but whether it does or not is still open to debate.
Let's open this up a little bit now to net zero and where we're going. And obviously, we've just had a change in policy in the UK, which literally just happened yesterday evening, and it's quite extraordinary. Now, I've seen from what you said is that I believe that you are in favor of keeping the 2030 deadline. I'm actually quite pleased that it's changed, because simply over the fact that I've always said that it would change. So it's just my prediction has come true, because I've been saying for years that we're never going to hit the 2030. Of course, it could again still happen, because obviously Keir Starmer is saying that he's going to bring it back as soon as he gets into power. So it might still happen anyway. But the point being, from my point of view, was that I think that, you know, and this is just a purely motoring journalist point of view, is that if a vehicle or a technology is so good that people should move to it, then they should just do that anyway by encouragement rather than by legislation. So that was always my point of view on this. It's like you should encourage people to move to EVs because they're better for them, not because you're punishing them. You know, so I think, or you're literally banning the alternatives. But having said that, you know, we may or may not have a new deadline. But looking at the fact that Rishi Sunak is still saying that we're going to hit that 2050 net zero, what are the changes do you see in real world transport? So this is not road haulage, but real world transport for like ordinary people going forward that could help us to achieve that. I mean, you know, if people like me stubbornly say, oh no, we need to continue having, you know, petrol V8s and stuff like that, are we ever going to get there, or do we have to literally give in and give up our vehicles entirely?
I think this is where we get into a lot of speculation and a lot of if, buts and maybes. My perspective is that cars have got fatter and fatter and fatter and heavier and bigger, and don't fit into parking spots. And we've allowed ourselves to be very wasteful in terms of vehicle sizes. So if I was starting from what can we do, I would say you need to stop. If you're in a hole, stop digging. And one of the holes is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So
but Duncan, the irony is
how we incentivize people.
But Duncan, the irony is that smaller cars are actually disappearing, and they're disappearing for two reasons: a, because the lack of the profit margins in producing them, producing the ICE cars for the manufacturers. But in terms of EVs, they're not necessarily working because of the battery pack sizes that are required. So you take something like the Honda E, which is a beautiful little car, a wonderful little offering from Honda, but it's a complete sales disaster because it just didn't offer the range that people expected it to offer.
When people are spending £30,000 on a car, they want it to do everything they want it to do. Very often when it comes to small cars, they can be, They can be second cars, but often they're not. Young single people, like my daughter, for example, she's got a Corsa, and that Corsa is quite fuel efficient. It does everything she needs it to do. It's got five seats. The dog fits in it. Her friends fit in it. It does everything she wants. She could have a friend of hers had a smart car who ended up not driving half the time because most of the people couldn't get in it. So people try and buy one car that does everything they need. Small cars have a market, but that market is always competing against the secondhand Corsa. So you have something which is smaller than a Corsa. You can either buy a secondhand Corsa or you can buy a new Volkswagen Up or something like that. I would always go for the secondhand Corsa because I think it's a more flexible car, but that's my choice. I think there's a lot of things around what we buy. A lot of people go to the public transport issue as a solution for climate change and what have you. And that has, I live in London. I don't own a car. My wife has, we have a family car. It's my wife's. I realized the other day that I have only ever owned one car in my entire life. I've had company cars. I had my parents' car when I was a student, or I've driven my wife's car, and that's it. I've had one car. It was a Chrysler Valiant in Australia a million years ago. VG Valiant, if anyone wants to look one up. And it was the uncoolest car imaginable for a young guy in his early 20s to have. But it was $500. So, yeah. You know. It had to do everything I needed it to do, which was carry me and my mates around. So I think public transport has a role, but it only has a role where public transport fulfills the transport needs of the people using it. It's no good pretending that Superloop that the mayor has introduced is doing anything other than being a publicity stunt. Yeah. It's just useless. I live in South London. The X68 is now the Superloop 6, or maybe it's Superloop 68. It's just down the road. I used to work at Waterloo for a bit, and it was the first stop once the express bus got there. I couldn't use it because it was unreliable. It gets caught in traffic. It's fine, but it's not a Superloop. It's not a train. It's not an underground. And so it didn't fulfill my needs. So it's about public transport fulfilling people's needs. And if you live in Slough and you work somewhere around Heathrow Airport, the chances of you being able to get to work by public transport are probably negligible.
And this is the thing, is ultimately what we're talking about here is introducing all these policies, such as ULEZ, such as, you know, LTNs and all these other restrictions, telling people these simple solutions. Oh, you can use the Superloop, you can use the bus, you can use public transport, which, like, as you mentioned earlier, if you're in Wales or in Scotland, this for a lot of people is not even an option. I've already had people messaging me saying that the 20 miles per hour limit in Wales has added over an hour and a half to their commute time. Is absolutely crazy for some people. Now, the point being with all of these things is that we're juggling with this balance, aren't we? Because at the end of the day, you know, I think we all agree that we want to, you know, save the environment. We want to have a better air to breathe, for us to breathe and for our families to breathe. But at the same time, we don't want to restrict completely human activity. We're ultimately humans, right? We're here to live, to breathe, to adventure, to work, to socialize, to do stuff. That's what we're about. So we can't just be told that you have to abandon everything and live at home and just spend your entire life looking at a screen.
Those points are really, that's really important. I think that's where I'm coming from. It's perhaps because of the freight, my knowledge of freight, understanding that mobility, be it freight mobility or personal mobility, is essential, right? So forget about suppressing people's mobility really angers them. Telling people how to be mobile really angers them. And when it comes to freight, suppressing mobility has a cost on business and people. I worked for the RHA during the COVID pandemic, and we were working with government on solutions, and there's a whole range of things that we were concerned about. You may have remembered the famous toilet paper shortage, which wasn't a shortage at all. It was just panic buying. But one of the things that we had to do in the trucking industry is make sure that we could keep everything moving, which it did. Yeah. Now, we had all sorts of problems that came up. One of them was truck drivers were being banned from using toilets at places where they were going to and from. And in all credit to the government and ministers and health and safety executive and a load of other people at the time, we managed to get that overturned. And I'm still boycotting some products because those companies stopped drivers from using toilets.
Wow.
In their facilities at the distribution centers. And it stopped after about 3 or 4 weeks because people realized that, you know, what do you expect the truck driver to do? Yeah. Some of the drivers had some very creative thoughts about what they should do in these circumstances. And as a professional trade body representative, I could not actively promote some of the ideas that they had. I'm pretty sure that some of them were
about to regale us with the stories of what people actually did in times of desperation.
That's not for this podcast. I'll leave it to people to fantasize. People can fantasize about what truck drivers thought.
I'm sure they already are.
How they may or may not have behaved. But, you know, it was really important that we have to, and right throughout the pandemic, freight kept moving. You did have things in the supermarket that ran out and were short for a very short period, but that was because of panic buying. It wasn't because of failures in the supply chain kept working, and that's what's critical. So when we're talking about mobility shouldn't be taken for granted. Mobility is absolutely fundamental. And I think when we all come back to this net zero situation, we need to understand that we need cheap, plentiful energy. It needs to be net zero. If you accept that the net zero thing, let's make it net zero. Even if you don't believe in carbon climate change, let's do it anyway. But what we have to do is make sure that we have plentiful, cheap and deliverable energy. And that's what I was talking about earlier, about energy for the trucks that are in the areas which batteries won't work. They need to still work because we still need to supply the people in the north of Scotland with the goods that they need, and they need to export the stuff that they make. So, and it's the same whether we're working as well. A lot of the TFL mindset, I think, and actually government mindset generally, is a very urban. It's like, I live in London, yeah. I live in a city, people can get around, they can use bikes, they can do this, that, and the other. But you go outside the center of the cities, people need much more flexibility in that. And more important than that, your plumber, your electrician, your gardener, they need to be able to get about. And that is motorized transport, because with the best will in the world, e-cargo bikes have a role, but they're very limited. And just because something works in one environment doesn't mean it works somewhere else. And I think this is one of the problems with the debate. We forget sometimes that different markets, different activities require different solutions. And we need to accommodate everyone's solution. So just kicking 10% of people who don't have compliant vehicles into touch, ignoring them, that's not good enough. We need to accommodate everybody. And that's where I would go politically. And that's one of the things that's sort of motivating me here.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. Contextualizing solutions, I think, is also very, very important. So as we're coming to the end of this, is there, you've done this incredible study, obviously, into the scrappage scheme. Is there anything else we can expect in the pipeline that is looking at the impact of
what I put on my LinkedIn page was just a summary, 2-page summary. And what I'm doing at the moment is beating all of the assumptions, logging them, putting a lot more. So later this month, hopefully I'll get it done this month. I want to put the whole thing up, what the assumptions were, the lessons, all of the lessons, not just the ULEZ scrappage scheme. But I just wanted to get the ULEZ scrappage one out there because so much was going on, and I'm thinking, I'm just sick of listening to some of the misrepresentations. And this is where we will get political. going around telling people about 4,000 people a year dying is just, it's ridiculous. I would always go back and ask the question, so how many lives is ULEZ expansion going to save? Hmm. How many lives? If you, you can actually back calculate something from the assessment, it effectively comes down to two lives, I believe.
Two lives
is what the mid case is. The low case is nothing. The mid case is two, and that's actually taking all of the minutes that people's lives and aggregating it up. So that's two out of 8.3 million people.
That's two. So you're saying two lives. Two lives, is that over a defined period?
That's what, in a year.
In a year. We're talking about the ULEZ expansion, realistically based on all of the data that you have and the information that you, and the research that you've done, two lives per year.
If you calculate, the Jacobs report says life years lost.
Yeah.
And it gives a number for life years lost. The average person lives 83 or 85 years.
Yeah.
So you've got life. So you take 85 and then you work that out, how many millions of people there are in. And then that's how you get to a number, which is the real impact that ULEZ theoretically has. I would contend we would be much better off spending our effort and time improving congestion at pollution hotspots. Instead of focusing on the whole of London, you need to focus on the roads where there are real problems. Brixton is a perfect example. Putney High Street.
Which is what actually Sadiq Khan originally said he would do. Because if you look at what he actually said after the re-election, that was actually the policy. The policy was not to expand it. The policy was to look at hotspots.
And this is for other people. I will leave it for other people to work out and assess why he may have changed his stated position, which was originally, no, we're not going to do a ULEZ for the whole of London because it's shown to be not very effective, which was his first statement. And what we're going to do is we're going to fix the hotspots.
Yeah.
It appears we've done the opposite. We've made the hotspots worse.
Yeah. What I really worry about now is that having, you know, because it's blown my mind a little bit that you've just worked out that it's two lives saved. And
maybe 2.7. Maybe 2.7.
Let's say two or three people. I mean, let's also reiterate the fact that every single life is precious and that any single loss of life is absolutely tragic and should be avoided at all costs. But at the same time, I've already anecdotally heard, and I cannot prove it, but one or two people have suggested to me that there's already been one or two suicides because of the impact of ULEZ, and whether this is because people have lost their businesses or they haven't been able to visit their family. I remember interviewing an old lady at a protest at Marble Arch. And she said to me, I said to her, what are you going to do? And she said, I'm going to jump off the roof. And I did urge her not to do that. But, you know, when you start to think of it in those terms, then you really think, oh, wow. I mean, have we done more harm than good?
If I could just say, one of the really important things when we do impact assessments and when we do consultations and when we do this sort of work, we have to look at all of the impacts. One of the things that worries me about a lot of the low emission zone, low traffic neighborhood stuff is that there's so much selectivity. You have campaigning academics, you have campaigning lobby groups, you have a load of people who are selecting what data they want to use to support the ideas. And just like the 10% were dismissed as unimportant, TFL and the mayor, this is what's happening systematically a lot of the time. And this sort of identity bias that you get, in other words, I can see all of these people over here are gaining. This is my lot. Anyone else? No, tough. I don't believe that van men can go hang them, can go get stuffed, because the people in my gentrified neighborhood are all doing really well, thanks. Yeah. And this is what I have a problem with. I have a problem with selectively not taking into account impacts on everybody. And it's a simple social justice issue. You need to make sure that you take everyone's impacts into account. And that's where that very last section of the Jacobs Impact Assessment, where they got 34 loads of people, groups of people, negatively impacted by this, ignored. Just ignored. Disabled people, old people, there was all sorts of people. I don't have it up on my screen. All just, oh, well, it's not that important because, you know, maybe we need to raise the money.
Duncan, we could talk about this for a couple of more hours, I reckon, but you're absolutely very right. And I think that it needs people, you know, with the experience and skill set and knowledge such as yourself to really think through the consequences of these things. I want to thank you so much for taking the time today to talk to me about this. I guess the easiest way for people to find you would be through LinkedIn.
Yeah, I'm on LinkedIn, Duncan Buchanan on LinkedIn. I don't post a great deal of stuff. I posted that particular paper a couple of weeks ago, maybe 10 days ago, because I'd been working on it before ULEZ was interrupted. I should have got it out ages ago, but it wasn't going to make any difference. The mayor was committed to actually doing it because he'd marched so far up and down the hill. But what I want to do is I want people to stop and think holistically about some of these things. And yes, clean air is a good thing. It doesn't mean ULEZ is a good thing. Decarbonizing is a good thing. It doesn't mean doing it in a particular way is a good thing. We need to do things in ways that work. So allowing the natural vehicle life cycle to come to an end is the low carbon approach. And yes, actually, when you replace petrol vehicles with electric vehicles, you save over 50% of the carbon over the life of the thing. Using UK Grid Act averages, that is. So I hope that's been helpful.
Thank you so much, Duncan. Thanks once again. This has been absolutely brilliant, and I hope that people have got some stuff to take away from this. I know I have. You've given me quite a lot to think about, actually. So thanks once again for joining me today, and hopefully we'll do this again soon. Brown Car
Guy. Hope you enjoyed that video. If you did, please, please hit the like button and share this video as well if you can. And while you're at it, check out these guys who also sponsor my content. I am deeply grateful to them because it helps me to buy new equipment, put fuel in the cars, and yes, buy a cup of coffee. You can do the same. Just go here or right here on YouTube. Just hit these three little dots down here and click on thanks. Make sure you're signed in first. My content is free, but this is how you can help me keep it that way. I may even send you a gift. Oh, by the way, watch this next.